Hello, I'm Luis Hernandez, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, if you love politics, this past week has been nothing short of a dream. There was Super Tuesday. We had two debates in Miami. The GOP race at least was interesting and contentious. Donald Trump won by a large margin, and Senator Marco Rubio dropped out of the race.
While it is not God's plan that I be president in 2016 or maybe ever, and while today my campaign is suspended, the fact that I've even come this far is evidence of how special America truly is. And all the reason more why we must do all we can to ensure that this nation remains a special place.
And now he's saying that he's not going back into politics.
I'm not going to be vice president. I'm not running for governor of Florida. I'm going to finish out my term in the Senate over the next 10 months. We're going to work really hard here, and we have some things we want to achieve, and then I'll be a private citizen in January.
And you're not going to rethink this and go back and file in April or May for this seat?
No, I'm not running for re-election to the Senate. As I said, I'm going to finish my term here, and then I'll be a private citizen.
And there are, of course, other important votes. On a more local level, Miami Beach voters said no to a hotel project. Well, I mean, sort of. Key West voters turned down the chance to buy a development to protect affordable housing. A lot for anybody who loves politics. And that's what we're going to talk about here to start off the program. And we want to hear from you. What are the big stories from this past week that are resonating with you most? Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. I want to start off with Patricia Mazzei, Miami Herald political reporter, talking about some of the big things we've seen, at least on the presidential race. Patricia, first of all, welcome to the program. When you hear Marco Rubio say, "No, I'm pretty much done with politics," what's running through your mind?
I think he's done with politics for now. But I would be surprised if we didn't see him come back. He's 40 years old. He loves politics. It has been pretty much his entire career so far. And while I think it would make sense for him to take some time off once his Senate term is over to work in the private sector, make some money. He's a father of four young children. I would be surprised if we just didn't see him come back or return to the public sphere in some way, you know, with a think tank, on TV, in an
All right, you're coming in and out on it, so we're going to keep trying you on this line. You know what, though? Let me play a little devil's advocate with you, though. Is it possible that maybe this election process for him running for the White House, as ugly as it can get, and it did get ugly at times, maybe it left such a sour taste in his mouth that he's like, you know, I don't want to go back to that?
I think that's always possible, but like I said, he said maybe ever. You know, he might not be president ever, but it's a maybe. It's not a definite. And he might be saying he's not going to run for governor in 2018, but there will be elections in the future, and the wave that caught him this year may not catch him again.
And also the fact they did ask him in that interview if he would consider running for governor in 2018 for Florida governor. And again, he's pushing any possibility of a public life, at least for now, as you said, off to the side. But is that a possibility? Is that something that he would be ambitious enough to want to go after that?
He could, because it's the biggest statewide position that will become open in 2018. But it would basically mean restarting a campaign shortly after leaving the Senate. And I'm not sure that's the kind of a recovery that he's looking for. It would also probably imply a Republican primary. The Agriculture Commissioner, Adam Putnam, has been laying down the groundwork to run for governor for a while now. There are other possibilities as well. And so I don't think it would be an easy race for him if he were to jump back in.
And, you know, I'm always fascinated by these campaigns when they're going into a much needed victory. And you think about going into into Super Tuesday, into Florida's primary. Rubio needed Florida. But all the polls said he is trailing Donald Trump by a lot. I'm just wondering what was going on in that camp, in the Rubio camp. Were they just hopeful, or did they understand the inevitable?
I think towards the end, they understood what was happening, but no campaign is going to go out and say, we know we're down 20 points and we're going to lose. They have to, keep rallying their supporters to the end and hope that the polls are wrong and that there will be some kind of collapse from their opponent. But the election in Florida is very long. It's many weeks of absentee voting by mail, and also there's 2 weeks of early voting. And it is difficult for a campaign to get organized here early enough to get all of its people out, and Rubio wasn't able to do that. No one did that. And as a result, Florida was just a reflection of the national mood, which is usually the way Florida elections turn out.
Again, the number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. What are your thoughts on Super Tuesday and where we're headed? It looks like Donald Trump is going to be the GOP nominee, at least for now. Hillary Clinton looks like the Democratic GOP or Democratic nominee, again, at least for now. What does that mean going into the general election? We'd like to hear your thoughts. So, Patricia, looking at the fact that Hillary Clinton was the big winner Super Tuesday, as was Donald Trump, looks like these two are headed on a collision course, maybe. There's always that maybe going into November. But from what we saw with Florida voters, what do you think we can expect in a general election if those two are having to battle it out?
Well, I think Florida could be tight again. It is still the nation's largest swing state, and Trump showed that he has got serious support here. He calls Florida his second home because he's got Mar-a-Lago, his estate in Palm Beach, and likes to spend a lot of time there. Clinton has a big base of support here. She won Florida in 2008, the year that she lost to Barack Obama. So it's for many years she's had supporters here. She has a lot of donors in South Florida as well. So both, I think, will plan to be here a lot if the election turns out to be between the two of them. And we heard from supervisors of elections who said they had to turn away some voters who were just not registered in the primary, because Florida is a closed primary, so you had to be a red Democrat or Republican to vote. And the sign of independent voters and new voters coming into the election, Trump likes to say, is a sign that he is bringing new people into the party, is a chance it's also anti-Trump people. But I would imagine we would see kind of those atypical voters come out again in November.
And real quickly, before I go to the phones, I just wanted to get a sense. One, I'm reading that Rubio may be throwing his support behind Ted Cruz. And two, where's Jeb Bush been?
Well, I think Bush decided that he was going to sit this one out, either because he, you know, still had hard feelings from the race, and also because maybe he saw the writing on the wall that Trump was going to win Florida, and you don't want to lose and then kind of back another person who's going to lose. So I'm not sure he'll step back in. He's met with John Kasich, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio before the debate in Miami last week separately. But it doesn't look like he promised anyone that he would endorse them. And as for Rubio, Cruz, he has said, is the kind of most conservative candidate left in the race. So ideologically, that might be the next person that he turns to. But, you know, at this point, it's all up in the air. If it goes to the convention, who people's delegates will support, how much endorsements will matter. This could be one of those unprecedented situations, and I've been skeptical about the possibility of a contested convention, but it's still out there, and the more time that that's possible, then the more we have to actually dig into those rules and figure out how all of this would work.
See, I don't care. Anybody could tell me that politics isn't fun. All right, let me go to the phones real quickly here. I want to start with Thomas in Miami. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call. I am a black Republican. I've run for office. I've worked in the George W. Bush administration as a pretty much appointed person in the Department of Education. And I can tell you, Lee Atwater would definitely not have approved of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a pretty much the birth of what the Republicans have been doing for the last, I don't know, 20 years, just in your face to minorities. And now you've got Trump, who's in your face to the Republicans, and now the Republicans crawl and are trying to essentially fix things so that he will not get the nomination. So if anyone believes that politics is not fixed, then this is clearly showing you that it is, and especially if Trump does not get the nomination. I will not vote for Trump because I do not believe.
All right, Thomas, I apologize. Definitely not. I apologize, Thomas. You're coming in and out, so I'm going to stop there. But I think I get the gist of what you're saying. And Patricia, before I let you go, real quickly to answer to what Thomas is saying, is that the GOP created him. They deserve him. and they're getting exactly what, you know, they've been throwing out there for years.
Well, I asked Rubio that question Monday, the day before he ended his campaign, and he was reluctant to put blame on the GOP, but said part of the problem is if you think that the party works as a unit, all you have to do is look at the past few months and realize that it does not, that there are factions, that it is not, for all intents and purposes, a functioning single party right now. It's fractious and divided, and it's going to take a while to shake out to see how it goes. And for callers like Thomas, I think the question will be, if they're not going to vote for Trump, what will they do? Will they vote for the Democratic nominee? Will they sit out the election? That'll be a really big question that people who are really offended by Trump are going to have to answer over the next few months.
All right. Patricia Mazzei, again, political reporter for the Miami Herald. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right. You know, turning a little bit to more local politics, again, some other big votes on Super Tuesday on the local level. Miami Beach, for example, voters had to vote on whether or not they wanted a convention center hotel, a very big building, sitting there right in the middle of the Miami Beach. Did they want it? And they did. 54% said yes, but guess what? They needed 60% in order to make it happen. Also, another big vote in Key West. Residents voted down the proposal to buy a 157 Perry unit or Perry Court rental complex for $55 million. And this was supposedly going to be a project to help, you know, for the creation of more affordable housing on Key West, which, of course, as we've been reporting for a long time now, very difficult to find affordable housing. All right, I'm joined now here in studio with me, Joy Fletches, Miami Herald reporter covering Miami Beach. Also joining us on the line is Nan Klinger, WLRN's Florida Keys reporter. Joy, let me start with you real quick. All right, so 54%, that's a majority. So it seems like Miami Beach residents wanted the hotel, but came up short. You needed 60%.
Right. That 60% threshold was actually created 3 years ago in the 2013 election cycle, when actually Mayor Philip Levine and two commissioners, Michael Grieco and Joy Malakoff, were elected, largely on the wave that of support that created that threshold, when the last big mega development for the Convention Center District was defeated. There was a previous proposal that had star architects from all over the world, big teams come and bid for this, and it was going to be the whole area around the Convention Center that included retail, residential, and then the Convention Center and a hotel itself. That fell away after the new commission came in and decided to redo it, to get the Convention Center started on its own renovation separately, and then do a hotel vote, which, after that election, because of a ballot question, became 60% instead of 50.
And not even 24 hours later, the county or city commission comes back and says, all right, let's look at trying to bring this back just a little bit differently. We spoke with, you know, Philip Levine, the mayor, and he was confident that that would happen. So what exactly did the commission decide Wednesday night?
They want the city staff to come back very quickly in April with viable options that would be palatable for voters, something that could pass.
What's a viable option? Is it was the building too big, or what? Because you also told me the other day, and we've talked about it on the program, traffic. So yeah. What's a viable option?
It's a great question, because the traffic issue, which is such it really gets to the heart of the Miami Beach voter, because traffic is so bad every day. How you put a proposal forward that doesn't answer that question, I'm not really sure. I mean, the site that they're looking for is right across the street from the convention center. The only other site that the city manager told me that makes any sense at all, besides that corner that just got rejected, is that parking lot between Meridian and Convention Center Drive, right north of the city of City Hall. But in that situation, you might be able to get a smaller building, lower, but you're across the street from neighbors and traffic, right? How do you deal with that?
You know, the other thing, too, is I think about this, like any project in South Florida, because of the fact that this area has expanded so much over the last 20, 30 years. And I'm thinking of my own lifespan in South Florida and how I've seen it grow. And you always hear that overdevelopment, but it's a given. This area is just growing. Nothing's really going to stop this from happening, is it?
Well, I mean, that's a big macro issue in a place, especially like the beach, where development is going gangbusters right now. And the hotel, for I think some voters that I spoke to, was sort of emblematic and symbolic of a vote against development, or, you know, if you want to call it overdevelopment. because of traffic, because of quality of life. There's sort of a tussle between, I mean, this is, this convention center deal is supposed to be something, a big boon for the tourism business, for local businesses, for what makes South Beach in a way. But there's another part that of a people, another group of people, another part of the community that makes South Beach what it is, permanent residents who just want to be able to get around and not have a lot of hassle and enjoy the beach and whatnot. So yeah.
you know what? I know people who live in an area for a long time like to keep it a certain way, but over time, you know, and I think about one other community, very different, but Sanibel on the other side, they try really hard to keep that very small, and you wonder how long that's going to succeed. All right, let me turn over to Nan Klinger down in our southernmost bureau. Nan, real quickly, help us understand this particular complex that voters decided not to buy. What's so unique about it? Where is it located in the city?
What you call the edge of Old Town. So when you're coming in from sort of the commercial district and entering the historic district, it's right on the edge. It was built by the Navy in the early 1990s, and it's an area that has historically been military housing. And then the Navy didn't need it anymore, and they sold it 3 years ago to a private developer for $35 million.
And then, of course, the vote was, should the city buy it? Should Key West buy it for $55 million?
Yep, the market has recovered here, and that's the price they tentatively agreed on with the current owners.
Who's living there? Who lives there now?
I would call it middle class. The rent is actually $2,400 for a two-bedroom townhome. Essentially, these are duplexes, and that sounds like a lot of money. That does not sound like affordable housing, right? But in Key West, it kind of is. So it's paramedics and teachers and nurses. You know, it's kind of the middle class of Key West.
Now, so the city wanted to buy it, and were they going to do anything with it? Because there's a temptation. I mean, you're talking about a property that boosts it up in value in a matter of a couple of years, a few years. There's a temptation, I would imagine, to want to turn some of that into some money-making opportunities. But what was the city going to do with it?
The city was going to keep renting it out to the tenants, like the tenants who are there now. The idea was that the current rents would support the bond payments. That was what the housing authority, which was going to manage it. So it would essentially become public housing.
If nothing happens next, if a developer wants to come in and does want to buy it, obviously they have the right to turn it into whatever they want. That would obviously force the people who live there now to have to go somewhere else. How many options are there for people who live there now to...
Very, very few options. In today's local newspaper, there are no unfurnished apartments for rent in the Lower Keys. And I think there's one furnished apartment, which is something like $3,500 a month. I went on Craigslist yesterday just to check out what was out there, and a lot of the rentals are only seasonal. The snowbirds own them. They want to rent them out, but then they want to come back in November.
Here's the thing I think about then when you hear a situation like that, and we have some of that in Miami, obviously, and even going up in Broward and Palm Beach County, but... what's unique about Key West is the fact that it's a small space, and so values are going up, property values are going up so quickly. Where in the world do people – that's a service industry area. Where do those people who work in the restaurants and bars, the people who are basically running that economy, where are they living?
People get really creative. People live on boats. People have a lot of roommates, even when they're, well into adulthood in their 30s, 40s, and beyond. People live in extremely small spaces that you wouldn't see in other parts of the country. Some people live further up the Keys where it's not what most people would consider affordable, but it's a lot more affordable than Key West.
And real quickly, let me say this real quickly before we run out of time, is this dead now? This project, prospect?
It's dead as far as the city buying it, yeah.
Okay. Nan Klinger, again, is the WLRN Florida Keys reporter, and we spoke with Joey Fletches, Miami Herald reporter covering Miami Beach. Thank you, Nan, Joey, so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right. President Obama is heading to Cuba. Our own Tom Hudson and Tim Padgett are already there. We're going to hear from them about what's happening in Havana on the eve of the president's trip. That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thank you. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, this weekend, President Barack Obama becomes the first sitting U.S. president to visit Cuba since President Calvin Coolidge almost 90 years ago. He's going to be meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro. He's even going to take in a baseball game. Now, the trip is not without controversy. Critics still argue that the U.S. is giving too many concessions to this to the communist island without putting more pressure on Castro to deal with human rights issues. Well, joining us via Skype, WLRN's Tom Hudson and the LATAM reporter Tim Padgett. All right, gentlemen, I wanted to get the sense, you've been there almost 24 hours now, sort of, close to, and I wanted to get the sense of really your impression. What, give me a sense of atmosphere, environment. What have you seen, and how many people have you talked to?
We've talked to a number of people, Luis, and a good afternoon from Havana, from the Cuban Press Center. I've talked to a number of people, lots of interest certainly in the president's visit, but business is also going on here. They're mostly excited, certainly individual Cubans, about the influx of interest in Cuba that this presidential visit has already brought. And we're talking about small things, but they mean big things in the lives of individual Cubans, drivers, restaurants, service providers that can provide service for all these journalists and other folks who are coming into town, into Havana, for this presidential visit. I think there's hope around the president's visit that he will speak to a number of the themes that the Pope hit upon, that Secretary of State Kerry hit upon when he was here, when the embassy opened. But there's also some cautious optimism in terms of waiting to see what the Castro regime and, of course, what the Cuban ultimate response could be in the days and weeks ahead.
And, Tim, I'm curious. You know, we hear from Cuban Americans about their feelings on these new relations between the two countries. But what about Cubans there on the island? What do they think about everything that's happened over the past year? And what are they expecting from this new relationship?
Well, their expectations are sky high, perhaps even too sky high in realistic terms. I think they're very enthusiastic about Obama's visit in terms, less in terms of political relations and more in terms of economic relations. I think they really, the report, for example, that you broadcast this morning for me, where we talked to a gentleman here who's an actor. But because of a lot of these changes that are going on that are allowing Cubans to conduct more of their own private business, he and his family are able to make more income. With that income, he's able to put on more theatrical productions here in Havana. So I think it's really they see Obama's visit as a chance to accelerate a lot of the economic changes that they're hoping will improve their lives here.
You know, Tom, we've seen the polls, and Cuban Americans, for the most part, a majority of them are open to these new relations. But I'm wondering, you know, are they communicating enough about what's happening here on this side with Cubans on the island about what's really going on? Because Tim just said maybe the expectations are a little bit high.
You know, it's tough for Cubans to get unfiltered news, of course, out of from the United States regarding all of the nuances of the U.S. policy changes. And these are nuanced, and these are very bureaucratic changes that are kind of in the language of the policy. So I have to say that probably not, to be frank. I think that it is more about a feel and an anecdote and an emotion on the streets of Cuba that they are seeing and feeling and hearing about more and more interaction with the outside world, certainly with Americans in the last 15 months, as travel restrictions have come down, as trade restrictions have come down, as financial restrictions have come down, but are still in place. They are seeing this in the restaurants, in the Quinto Propistas, the small entrepreneurs and opportunities. We will be featuring one gentleman on the Monday Sunshine Economy, a gentleman who is in the business of making decorative bags, and he will be supplying some of the decorative bags that will go to the presidential contingency with President Obama in the White House, who will be coming here later this weekend.
And Luis, let me add to that example that Tom's just talking about. This is a perfect example of the expectations. This gentleman that we spoke with this morning, this impresario, he makes a lot of his big problem as an entrepreneur is getting paper to make the bags. What he's hoping for is that Obama will be able to change regulations to the extent that he'll be able to import paper to make things a lot better for his business. And that's why this visit, not just symbolically, but concretely for him, is very, very important.
Now, it's symbolically, though, but and that's something interesting. And you talked to, and you just said that, you know, he's hoping Obama, that Obama's going to be able to do this with him, and Obama's going to be able to open up all these things. So, yes, we've seen these changes. And again, this week, we also reported how the White House, again, loosening those some of those restrictions. But really, what are we seeing on the ground there as to how it's affecting them? Yes, more of us can now travel to Cuba. Yes, now more business can be done. But what do we see? What's really happening with the business owners there? Are they able to get more paper? Are they able to get more supplies? Are they able to do more of the things that these things are supposedly promising them?
Louis, they're able to figure out ways to do it. There is no wholesale market. This gentleman that Tim interviewed today, there is no wholesale market of paper and bag supplies for him to go buy from here in Cuba. Instead, it is figuring out workarounds with the embargo and other kind of creative ways to fuel this very young, very small entrepreneurial activity. I was up before sunrise this morning on the Malecón speaking with Cubans who were waiting for buses. And a number of them obviously knew the president was coming. They're interested in what the president has to say. When you ask them, what would you like to hear from the president? They'd like to hear about what they call the blockade. They'd like to hear about more and more exchanges of people. When you ask them if they expect the president's visit in a year's time or 2 years' time to perhaps lead to additional liberties, they become very quiet. They become much more reserved in their expectations, or at least what they're willing to share with a couple of journalists from Miami.
And again, we're talking with WLRN's Tom Hudson and our LATAM reporter Tim Padgett via Skype. They are in Havana. And you guys mentioned you're in a media center. I mean, we'd hear all these noises in the background. It sounds like they're either building something or something's going on there back there behind you.
I think they're making a cappuccino for a correspondent from Italy.
There you go.
Actually, yeah.
You know,
we have a slew of correspondents pouring into Havana today.
You know, Tom, something you mentioned just interestingly now, and I wanted to, that was the next question I wanted to get to, was to ask about, have you been able to talk to anybody about the human rights issue? And that's obviously one of the things we hear on this side. A lot of the critics are angry, and they say the U.S. is giving up too much, and they're not pushing the Castros enough on the human rights issue. But do people openly talk about that there?
The handful of Cubans that we've been able to engage with on the streets and asking them about any number of different things, expectations for the president's visit here, will they be listening or watching the president if they're able to on Tuesday morning when he is due to deliver his speech here in Havana, what the last 15 months have been like in their lives, all these types of questions. And they don't directly go to human rights. They don't discuss that necessarily. They don't discuss freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, those kinds of things that we discuss in South Florida, unless you ask directly about them. But, you know, talking with one Cuban this morning at a bus stop, I asked about his family, if his children were aware. He has a preteen in his household, and I asked if they were aware of the president's visit, and he said they were not, that they're not talking about the president's visit in his children's school, for instance.
And, Louis, I would add that I think they do think about it, but what they're thinking about it through the prism, again, of economic and business change. They're looking at the possibility of gaining more personal independence through businesses and economics, and what they're hoping is that then in turn will lead down the road to more democratic and human rights independence, let's say.
They're very proud here, Louis, talking to the same gentleman at the bus stop, asking about his life in Cuba. He loves living in Cuba. He loves to continue to live in Cuba. I said, what would make his life better? Dinero.
Money. More money. One of the interesting things that came down with some of the changes announced this week, too, is the fact that Cubans can now negotiate a little more openly with U.S. businesses about working for U.S. companies. And obviously, you know, one of the things that that leads to is really the discussion of baseball players. And
exactly,
you know, now baseball players may not have to try to get out of the island, escape the island to come to America to play. Now baseball teams may be able to negotiate for those players. We also have, you know, people know, but just to remind them that anybody who does, whenever Cuba sends actors, doctors, or athletes anywhere to work, the government gets a piece of that money they make. Does that change? Does that change at all now? And really, I mean, is this really open where, like, now you can just start, if you have a specialty, you can start talking to U.S. companies that openly?
That's a very good question, Lewis, because what we're trying to figure out is, where has Obama been able to chisel away at the embargo through executive action, and at what point does he hit a brick wall where only the embargo, only lifting the embargo, excuse me, I should say, goes into that territory that you're talking about? And it's a little murky right now. For example, if a baseball player, you know, a very good example you point out, wants to negotiate directly with Major League Baseball, is Major League Baseball then going to have to negotiate with the Castro government in terms of how much of his multi-million dollar salary goes back to Cuba? And is this something that Obama can deal with through executive action, or is it something that only Congress can deal with by lifting the embargo? I mean, it's as I said, it's very unclear right now.
You know, Tom, you mentioned not everybody is talking about President Obama's visit, and you know, anybody who's ever had the chance to go, you know, to cover a presidential visit to any place, there's a lot of security involved. It really does, you know, put a lot of hamper on traffic and everyday life. I'm wondering if Cubans are ready for or understand what it means when Air Force One lands there and the President of the United States is going to be spending some time in their city.
I don't think they do. There's not much of a frame of reference for the kind of infrastructure that comes with a presidential visit from a sitting United States president. A papal visit, the Pope visiting, of course, brings its own significant challenges and infrastructure into a city. The Secretary of State coming to visit for the first time in a half a century, which happened last summer, of course, with the flag raising at the U.S. Embassy. But in terms of a presidential visit and the kind of security bubble that surrounds a president, this city has certainly not experienced firsthand in modern times.
In the next few days that you both of you are going to be there, what are some of the things that you are trying to get out to see and some of the people that you want to talk to? And do you get the sense that you're not going to have any trouble doing that?
No, I really think that the Cuban government, at least during this visit, wants us to get out and see how, for example, normalization is working. I think they want us to look at, for example, how they're making conditions better for U.S. businesses, perhaps to invest here once the embargo is lifted. But I think, you know, one of the big points of tension here, as you mentioned earlier, is that perhaps Cuba isn't doing enough to make a case for lifting the embargo, not just human rights issues, although those are important, but also, are they creating business conditions for large companies to make it worth their while to invest here? And so I think, you know, for example, you've got a special development zone that they've created out in Mariel, where they've renovated the port for $1 billion, and that's one of the crown jewels that they point to. But it's not the same Cuba, for example, that we would have seen a decade ago in terms of turning away from the United States. It's a Cuba that's really turning toward the United States in ways, in my career as a Latin American correspondent, I've never seen before.
You know,
and
Tom,
it may not have been the type of Cuba we would have encountered just 18 months ago prior to the original announcement by the Obama administration, Lewis. And regarding, you know, some of the stories we'll be telling, it's really understanding this engagement in the last 15 months, not only on the part of Americans looking into the island, but also Cubans and the opportunities and the challenges that the Cuban community has encountered. And regarding kind of the freedom of the ability to tell these stories, I have to say, late last night, we happened to be walking by the front of the American embassy, and I was going to take a photograph. A guard came out and asked us not to photograph the American embassy ahead of the president's visit. That's been the only portion of our work that we've been asked not to do.
And, you know, I wanted to ask, too, real quickly, because you mentioned how, again, some Cubans don't know the president's coming. They don't know what to expect. But, see, I don't know if that answers this question, though. Do they know about the presidential race here in America? Do they care about it? Because you think about this, the next person who takes the White House, what does that mean for the relations and this relationship? But I mean, what are they saying about our politics and our election season?
Well, as Tom mentioned earlier, they really don't get a lot of U.S. news here. I mean, you know, they listen to Radio RT, perhaps some of them, but they don't get CNN. You know, they're not watching CNN and Fox and MSNBC. Let's just say that. I don't really think they're very aware of the sort of shocking spectacle that's going on right now with regards. And when you talk about the Cuban government, what matters to them is who's going to be taking over the White House next January, and will that person keep this new policy of engagement toward Cuba that President Obama has established in place.
But do you get
that's
a sense,
really what they care about.
Do you get a sense of which candidate or which party they would prefer?
No, not really, Louis. I think that for the majority of Cubans, it is still survival. It's looking for their own personal opportunities, the opportunities for their families within the system that they have known for so long, and the hopes and wishes that they have for that system to evolve.
But we can say, though, that President Obama is remarkably popular here. And so in that sense, I think they are much more deeply engaged with U.S. politics than they've ever been before.
We've been talking with WLRN's Tom Hudson and our LATAM reporter Tim Padgett. They joining us via Skype from Cuba. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you.
All right, and don't forget, listen for more stories from Cuba on WLRN next week. All right, coming up next, we're going to be talking about a report that came out recently about possible pollution, radiation pollution in Biscayne Bay. Should we be concerned about our water? That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, just a couple of years ago, FPL's Turkey Point nuclear plant expanded. After that happened, there were problems with the cooling canals around the plant. They were heating up. And earlier this month, Miami-Dade County released a report that said the plant has been leaking dangerous wastewater into Biscayne Bay. Monitors found more than 200 times the normal levels of tritium in the bay. That's a radioactive isotope linked to nuclear power production. FPL says it's doing all it can to protect the bay waters and that our waters are safe. Well, let's join now by Eric Szilagyi. He is the president of Florida Power and Light. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
You're very welcome, Luis. Thanks for having me on the show.
Also joining me in studio, Rachel Silverstein. She is Miami Waterkeeper Executive Director. That's a Miami-based 501c3 nonprofit organization that advocates for South Florida's watershed and wildlife. Rachel, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You know, Eric, let me start with you. The report comes out, and obviously now all of your critics, all the critics for FPNL, all the critics for the Turkey Point nuclear plant come out and say, see, we told you so. We said there were problems, you know, with having nuclear power in South Florida, but also having it here on the bay. What was your response when that report came out?
Well, you know, Luis, I will tell you, it's you know, there's always going to be critics of nuclear power. We've seen that for decades from when the plant was first built. I think a little history on this is important to understand. You know, these cooling canals were originally designed because they were mandated through litigation by the federal government that we actually build these canals. And we built them per that settlement agreement with the federal government back in the 70s. And they're permitted as industrial waste pond. And we've operated them per those permits, frankly, very proudly now for the last 40-plus years.
And real briefly, could you help us understand, because, you know, we've reported on it, too, about these canals heating up. And what's really happening there?
Well, what's happening is that they're serving their purpose on acting like a big radiator is what they are. There's 180 miles of canals that have about 5 billion gallons of water, and they provide cooling to the power plant that's there. It's frankly to a complex of power plants, which include Turkey Point 3 and 4, which are the two nuclear reactors. Now, what happened in the past few years is that, as you know, because you live there, we had some pretty extreme drought conditions over the plant area. This is a closed system, so from a perspective of it doesn't have regular flows and out, you know, doesn't connect to the bay, we rely on Mother Nature through rainwater to replenish what evaporates naturally every day off the plant.
Because there
it's
have
a big
been,
area.
There have been times when a number of points during this drought where, of course, we've had to release fresh water into those canals to help keep them cool.
Well, what we did is we actually were able to, we drilled some wells that took brackish water, not fresh water, and added it to the canals. And then we actually injected some fresh water from runoff, from drainage canals that go by, and we took some excess that was going to go into Biscayne Bay. The bay gets the vast majority of fresh water that comes from water runoff, effectively, from you know, to the north, and it flows down south.
All right. Well, all right. So, Rachel Silverstein, so this report comes out. What was your response to it?
Yeah, I think it's very important for the public to understand how these canals work. And as Eric mentioned, they act like a giant radiator to cool the nuclear power plant. But the canals are also unlined. And in Florida, we have very porous limestone geology. So whatever happens on land and water that goes on land very quickly sinks and has connection with our groundwater. And the Florida Power and Light Turkey Point plant happens to be sitting on top of the Biscayne Aquifer, which is a 4,000 square mile aquifer that's also the sole source of drinking water for over 3 million people. So when the water in the canal gets very hot and evaporates, it gets very salty, and everything in the canals really gets concentrated, and that water sinks, and it sinks down into the bottom of the Biscayne Aquifer to about 80 feet deep, where it hits a layer that's impenetrable, and it's been spreading underground for miles for many years, and it's about 4 miles away from the plant now.
Eric Szilagyi, obviously, look, people are going to say, this is our drinking water, and there's going to be a concern. And if you threaten the drinking water, you're going to hear the outrage. But, I mean, what can you say to people and convincing them that the water's safe?
Sure, Louis. So let me be very clear on this, because we have monitoring wells all around the cooling canals and the plant, and there have been absolutely no impacts at all to drinking water. I mean, that's just a fact. And the areas that have been concerned, and what you talked about earlier in your lead-in about radiological material, specifically tritium, that has been picked up in the monitoring wells just outside of the canals on FPL property that are in some deep pools, are at levels that are far, far below what the U.S. EPA deems safe for drinking water.
But you say it's a fact.
That's a fact. The drinking water standards for the U.S. EPA is 20,000 picos per liter, the highest reading that's been by any of the monitoring wells, including, by the way, inside the canals, to address Jenny's point of the water sinking down, is 4,317.
All right.
Sorry, I said right, Jenny, I meant Rachel.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's 78% below what the EPA says is safe for anybody, including the elderly, infants, anybody, to drink water.
By the way, none
of us are dipping our glass into Biscayne Bay and drinking the water out. But if you did, it would be safe to do so.
Okay, Rachel, by the way, my understanding of tritium, and this is something that is naturally found in places, but, you know, you would have to consume a lot of it for it to really be of a health concern to people or to fish. But, you know, I mean, you're not convinced that they're doing enough, that FPL is doing enough to protect the water.
No, and there are two things going on. The first is the plume of salty contaminated water going into our aquifer. And what we realized last week with the county's report showing tritium, phosphorus, and ammonia levels being very elevated in Biscayne Bay, adjacent to Biscayne National Park, and of course the Turkey Point plant that borders the national park, was showing that the cooling canal water is in fact not a closed-loop system, and it actually is getting into Biscayne Bay. So two things are going on, contamination of the aquifer and contamination of Biscayne Bay. And to the point about the tritium levels, in fact, the maximum contamination level set by the EPA for how many picocuries of tritium you can have in drinking water is 20,000 picocuries per liter, but the California has set a public health goal of only 400 picocuries per liter, of which the amount of tritium found in the samples in the bay far exceeds that level.
And so if
this was happening in California, this would be a drinking water problem.
And Eric, right, real quickly, there was a state judge did find that state regulators had failed to enforce the law and ruled against you, stating that the utility failed to prevent hundreds of thousands of gallons of wastewater from seeping into the bay.
No, Luis, that's a separate issue having to do with what Rachel was speaking about on the hypersaline water, the salt water. And we actually have worked and have an agreement in place that the judge was actually, simply because of timing, not allowed to consider, that we have an agreement in place with Miami-Dade to work on making sure that saline water doesn't continue to travel. Look, this was known when the plant canals were originally designed that there was going to be hypersaline water produced. It was going to sink down. Actually, the original permit that was issued by the government contemplated that we would simply flush the canals into the bay. Now, we thought better of that and decided we were never going to do that and close loop the system to make sure that wouldn't occur. So we've come up with a plan that's been in place now for several months working with the county that the judge, because of just the, you know how it goes sometimes with litigation on timing, was not allowed to consider. And so we're confident that when that information is now in front of them, because that litigation is closed, that will meet the requirements necessary.
Let me finish on this. I'm going to ask both of you this
one. And it has nothing to do with tritium, Luis. I want to be clear. That has to do with saltwater.
Okay. Real quickly, too. You had a meeting recently with Mayor Carlos Jimenez. And so there's no violation notices being given out right now. But you tried to convince the mayor you're doing all that you can. What did the mayor say that he's unhappy about? What's he expecting from you?
Well, the mayor is expecting of us. First off, we had a great meeting with the mayor and his team. You know, we addressed all of these issues, including what Rachel talked about with the ammonia samples that were found, again, just next to our plant canals. We don't produce ammonia at Turkey Point. It's not a chemical plant. There is a lot of vegetation. I'm sure you've seen it. It dies. It decomposes. And I'm not happy that there is ammonia in small quantities right next to the cooling canal. So what we told the mayor is it's on our property. I can't help the fact that plants die and decompose, but what I can do is remove that ammonia. We're going to take responsibility, and we're going to put it right back into the canals where when it gets mixed in with the 5 billion gallons, it gets diluted rather than sitting in these isolated little pockets.
Rachel,
if you go out into the bay, there are no issues with regards to health of concentration levels. If you go 100 yards away from the canals, you find very quickly that the levels drop off to very tiny amounts, trace amounts.
All right, Rachel Silverstein, I'm going to give you the last word here. Is, I mean, really, from what the mayor is not giving any notices right now, a violation, but, we, you know, again, did mention the court order. I mean, what's next? What else do you do? FPL says they're on this.
Yeah, the mayor did ask in the county commission meeting for a more modern solution to this plume problem to be found. And, you know, FPL does not have permission to have this hypersaline plume leaving its property and going, spreading underground for miles and moving at a rate of about a foot a day towards our drinking water supply or putting any of this water into the bay. The relevance of the ammonia and the phosphorus being in the bay is that it can create algae blooms. We have a very beautiful bay, and those chemicals going into the bay can turn it brown, it can turn it green, it can smother fish and seagrass, and that's exactly why those canals were built and because FPL is not allowed to be discharging into the bay.
This is a topic we're going to continue to discuss, and I want to thank both of you for taking the time to be here. We'll come back to it again. Rachel,
I want to thank you for having me on the show and remind everybody, too, that you know we're very proud of the fact that this plant has operated now with zero emissions for over 40 years. You shouldn't lose fact. You know, the fact is, we've produced power now without producing hundreds of millions of tons of CO2 that would have gone in the atmosphere.
I have to stop you there only because of time. Eric Szilagyi, president of the Florida Power and Light, and Rachel Silverstein, again, executive director with Miami Waterkeeper. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is the program. Thank you so much for joining us today. That will do it for the Florida Roundup. We want you to join our new Facebook group, post your comments about today's show. Tell us what are you talking about and how these topics affect you. Join us at facebook.com/groups/ The Florida Roundup. The Florida Roundup is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's program directors, Peter M., and our technical supervisors, Paul Leary. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us.